is the wholesale rate design. So I'll turn it over to you and let you tell us where to go.
Exactly right, Graham. I'm going to introduce this topic and then fairly quickly hand it off to Peggy, who's going to walk us through a few things here. But we've talked about cost of service now a number of times, and we've talked about customer classes versus the cost of service and their cost to serve. We've even talked quite a bit about internal equity within the classes and rate structure to address some of the out of balance that has been created over the last few years. And so what we're going to do today, Peggy is going to try to kind of synthesize all of those discussions and walk through that and bring the board to some decision points or some at least some discussion points. Obviously, we won't be taking any action or making any final decisions today. But as we walk through this, I want you to think about really four basic questions. And one of those, the first one, I think, and the most important one is, do we want to move towards rates for each customer class that align their revenue with their cost of service? Seems like a pretty obvious answer, but I think that's something we need to decide if that's the direction we want to go. Number two is, do we want to do anything with internal equity within the customer classes? And specifically, do we want to consider some sort of a fixed fee component that would help recover the cost for maintenance of assets that are used by customers on their maximum day? Do we want a fixed fee that has them moving towards paying for the maintenance cost of those assets that they use to meet their demand? Third, do we want to consider any kind of an inclining rate that would move us more even towards internal class equity as it relates to specifically to peaking and the magnitude of the peak? And then lastly, if we want to do any of those things or all of those things, what kind of timeline do we want to think about? 2-3 years, what makes sense? So you can be thinking about those things as Peggy walks us all through, and then there will be plenty of time to discuss all of that when Peggy gets through. So with that, I think I'll hand it to Peggy and let her walk through her presentation.
All right. Let me share my screen. All right, can you see a slideshow?
I can see a slideshow.
Yeah.
All right. So, Ted, that was a great lead-in. You might have read my slides ahead of time.
Or even seen the presentation.
Perhaps, yes. So, Ted synthesized it pretty good, but let me just kind of walk through this a little bit. So here's where we are. You know, we have had several presentations from Raftellus on both cost of service and rates and rate design. In fact, the examples I'm going to use today are the ones that Raftellus put together for us. So this is not new information, but it's, the things that we really think we've narrowed down that we need to consider, as Ted kind of outlined it there. And based on the discussions that we've had in several of these presentations and discussions with Raftellus even, not just presentations, but discussion with them, we think that there's consensus for a couple of things. The first one being that cross-subsidization should not occur, cross-subsidization between customer classes, and that we want to move towards wholesale customers paying their way, which is not the current situation. So this slide, this is Raftellus option one. And this is the same rate structure as current. So this is not a change to the current rate structure, but it does increase the volume rates to cover 100% of the costs assigned to the class. So the purchase capacity rate would go from the current 233 to 287 per 1,000 gallons, and the with storage rate would actually go down from, it's currently at 444, it would go down to 359. And it gets the customers to of the class to 100% of covering their costs. Now, one thing I wanna make sure to point out here is that all of these scenarios that Raftellis did are based off of our 2020 budget data, as opposed to the current or the future. So they put the 2020 budget data into the model and ran these. As we continue our budget development, you know, we're just now really getting into the thick of budget development, but once we've have our 2021 budget in a more finalized form, not final, but at least a better form, we'll need to put those numbers into the model. So these will change. So think of it like this, today, instead of 233, the purchase capacity rate should be 287. If in 2020, we were going to have the class cover 100% of their costs. So if we do nothing else, you know, setting aside whether we want to change the rate structure or not, if we do nothing else, I think the message we heard loud and clear from Raftellis and their analysis on the cost of service is that the wholesale rates, the wholesale purchase capacity rate needs to go up, and actually the wholesale with storage rate needs to go down. But as Ted kind of alluded to, you know, in Raftellis, throughout all of our discussions, really from day one, when we engaged them and they started looking at what our rate structure was and just some of the things that they knew about us, without even doing analysis, they began to suggest that perhaps we would want to change the structure of our wholesale rates. One of the things that they picked up on very quickly is that we really might want to ensure that all of our customers pay a share of capital costs, even if they are purchasing very little water from us or no water at all. That was one of the first things they hit on. And also to address intra-class equity, which we're gonna talk a little bit more about. You know, that's one of the things that really struck them is that when you look within the class, within the purchase capacity class, at the individual cost recovery, there's a broad range of percentages there, and they would suggest that we might want to change the structure to improve upon that. So today we're going to really focus on two of the options that Raftellis presented, but before we jump into those, I want to talk just a little bit about the Wholesale Water Service Master Agreement. The master agreement has been in effect since 2005, and we believe that the discussions that we have today, are going to have today, and the options that we're going to look at are allowed under the master agreement for a couple of reasons. This section says water rates to be charged by Des Moines Water Works to participants for water shall be set in Des Moines Water Works' sole judgment based on costs and other customary factors, and shall be set so as to prevent service to participants from being subsidized by other consumers and service to other consumers being subsidized by participants. Again, hits at that no cross-subsidization. The other piece that really supports where we're going with this is Des Moines Water Works' judgment reasonably reached shall be final as to the establishment of water rates. So we think that that's, you know, really provides us the basis for restructuring the wholesale rate if we choose to do that. Now, there is also some constraining language in there that does set some limits on some options that we might have otherwise considered. The first, and these are really in essence the same thing, but that Des Moines Water Works has established and will continue to establish a rate previously referred to as the WIS storage rate, and it still is, for water utility customers that do not purchase capacity or exceed purchase capacity, and a lower rate referred to herein as purchase capacity rate, and then goes on to say the purchase capacity rate shall be less than the WIS storage rate. So that's a key factor to keep in mind as we move forward here. So I put this in kind of a question format, and then with a couple of not so much answers, but things to consider. So the first question, you know, as we move forward from just simply keeping the same rate structure and increasing it to looking at something else, and one of the options, as you're aware, that Raftellis has talked about is a larger fixed component. And so do we support a fixed rate component to recover fixed costs regardless of usage? A larger fixed component than the meter charge that's in place today. So a primary pro of this is that it recovers costs for us, the fixed cost to maintain capital, even if they're not buying any water. And so as Raftellis has presented this option, they based it on maximum day or half of the purchase capacity amount, whichever is greater. So for customers who aren't buying any water from us, they would pay this larger fixed component based off of half of their purchase capacity. Another positive to this is it does improve intra-class equity. It gets it a little more equitable within the class, but the flip side of that is a con of it is it does not fully align the costs within the class. It does not get to full intra-class equity. And so here's what that looks like. This is Raftellis option three. Note, I skipped option two for a couple reasons. First of all, I kept the same numbering option as Raftellis used in their presentation to us last month. So that if anyone is looking at both presentations, they will be the same options. And we're skipping number two now, but we will touch on it briefly later. So this option shows a fixed charge of $158 per max day, 1,000 gallons for purchase capacity, and $211 per max day, 1,000 gallons for the WIS storage customers. And then this column that says annual fixed charge is what the calculation for each of those customers would be. Under this option, the volume charge goes down to $2 per 1,000 gallons for purchase capacity and to $2.25 for with storage. And you'll see that the class is a total. It gets some, the cost recovery is 100%. But again, if you look in the numbers over in the side within the class, there is still some intra-class inequity. It's better than option one, but it's not 100%. So the next question and that we internally talked about is, do we want to send a pricing signal for peaking greater than 2 times average day? So some pros of this are it targets costly peaking behavior. It does improve intra-class equity. And another thing that we like about this is it is adaptable to changing behavior over time. And what we mean by that is certainly many options you could say that about. But, you know, as we were trying to decide and talking through with Raftellis, you know, what peaking do we target? Okay, so they started it at greater than 2 times average day, but that could be changed over time. It could be increased or decreased depending on how customer behavior changes and how we might want to direct that change. Now, some cons to this, and the first one is really probably the most significant con, frankly, is that it is, from a billing perspective, a much more complex structure. It is doable, but it will be much more complex. Additionally, when you're looking at this as compared to the previous option, it really only results in a 1-2% difference at the most for customers as far as in cost recovery. So it does improve the interclass equity, as I said, one of the pros, but it doesn't change it a whole lot. And frankly, that's the last con we've listed, is it still does not fully align costs within the class. And this is what it looks like. So again, this was Raftellis' option 4 in their presentation. So the fixed costs are the same, $158 per max 8,000 gallons for purchase capacity, $211 max 8,000 gallons for with storage. It results in the same annual fixed charge per customer. But in this case, the first block of volume would go down to $1.91 for purchase capacity and $2.12 for with storage. And then the second volume inclines. So it goes up, and it goes, at least in this example, to $2.86 for purchase capacity and $3.17 for with storage. Now, this graph shows what I said as one of the cons, is that as far as when we're looking at the two and comparing the cost recovery between having a uniform volume charge and an inclining block, again, both of them with the same exact same fixed annual charge, it doesn't really change it a lot. Here's the 100% that we would be ideally after. For some customers, there's a few percent difference, but for some customers, it's virtually the same no matter which option we would use. All right, now this is option 2 in Raftellis's numbering scheme that I skipped. And the reason I skipped it is because we don't recommend it. In this one, again, it's the same fixed charge, the 158 per max day, 1,000 gallons, and the 211. But in each customer, they have a volume rate specific to them. Now, the reason Raftellis prepared this option for us is we had asked, a number of times in different examples about getting each customer to 100% cost recovery. And this, it would take a structure like this to get each individual customer to 100% cost recovery. However, the reason we don't recommend this is we don't feel that this meets the contract language. Hark back to the constraining language slide that I showed you, and the contract says that the purchase capacity rate must be lower than the with storage rate. And in this case, we would have a few customers who would have a higher purchase capacity rate than some of the with storage customers. And so we don't recommend this because we just don't think it meets the contract language. I want to talk about a few other considerations. The first one is one of the things that we had a little bit of discussion about with staff is one thing that we could consider is adopting the higher fixed fee with a uniform volume rate, which is option 3 for 2021, and then consider implementing the inclining rate in 2022 or 2023. And the reason that we throw that out there is, you know, this would give more notice, obviously, to our customers that inclining rates are coming at some point in the future, and would allow communities time to work to reduce their peak if they so choose to do so. You know, they can consider their options and work to reduce it. So something to consider. The second item here is, and we've talked about this a little bit, but we just want to make sure that we visit again today about it, and that is having a 3-year phase-in. Again, from day one, as Raftellis talked about, a fairly significant change to the structure said, oh, you know, you'd want to phase this in. It's typically what their customers do. Let me put it that way. They work with a lot of clients on these type of things, and they typically see a phase-in period. They say 3 years is pretty common. Shorter than that, and it's not really phasing it in. Longer than that, and it just feels like you're not getting to where you want to be with any expediency. So they would suggest 3 years. And the last item that we wanted to suggest is to make the wholesale rates effective July 1, 2021, rather than April 1. Obviously, this gives the customers more time to plan. But more importantly, you know, many communities have a fiscal year, a July 1 to June 30 fiscal year, as opposed to a calendar year like we do. So an April 1 rate increase is, in fact, an April 1, 2021 rate increase would be in the fiscal year that they are currently in, the fiscal year that just started for them July 1. So if we delayed to July 1, the rate increase or the rate change to July 1, it gives them time to include the change in their next year's fiscal budget. So here's the short version. We believe we need to align cost recovery, revenue in essence, with costs. And so the question is, are we comfortable with a larger fixed component based on max day or half of purchase capacity? And if so, do we want to implement a uniform volume charge or an inclining block volume charge? Because recall, both of those options had the same larger fixed component. So option one that we looked at first is simply keeping the same rate structure, but raising the rates. Number three, skipping numbers, starts with a larger fixed component, but has a uniform volume rate, or option four goes to an inclining block volume charge. With that, I think we're kind of to questions and discussion. And Ted, did I miss anything, or is there anything you would like to add or clarify?
One thing I would add, Peggy, is that we have received correspondence from two of our wholesale customers that I have shared with the board, basically expressing opposition to a change in the rate structure, specifically related to fixed fees or anything associated with peaking. Discussion about the timing versus regionalization, whether the agreement allows for this kind of change or any change really, and whether this change aligns with the spirit and intent of the whole purchase capacity process that was originally put in place. And so we've received those, or certainly are considering those and will respond, but just want to mention that we did receive those and have shared that information. So with that, I guess I would be interested in questions from the board or perspectives that you may have on where we are.
Ted, You know, after reading the Urbandale letter, I felt that we have some more education that we need to do. You know, we're in the middle of talking about regionalization and trying to build trust, which has come up on the two meetings that we've had. And so I just want to say, I think we still have a lot of education, and the reason for why we're looking at doing this, that it doesn't feel to me like it's really come through yet to get the letter that we did from Urbandale and hear what we heard. So just my initial take.
Do you have any ideas, Sue, on that? I mean, you've talked to Urbandale as, you know, as much as anybody. Do you have any ideas about what we should be doing differently?
Yes. I think it's just more dialogue, more continued conversation, letting them see behind the curtain and to know what it is that we are experiencing and decisions that we're having to make. I was really stunned to get that letter because I thought, Graham, we had been doing a pretty good job of it. And so to read that letter and think, oh my gosh, I was a little bit more than disappointed, but I'm going to put it on us and say, what can we do that's better?
This is Diane, and I have a couple of responses to that. I think some of the reaction, I'm not sure that, I think a lot of it goes to, they don't think that it's acceptable under the agreement. And that's a legal question. I think it is. And secondly, they don't like it. I'm disappointed that we didn't hear from some of the other members of the class who have been paying more than their share. The agreement clearly says that we should not be cross-subsidizing. And as somebody who's done rates for years and years and years, you're never going to get to perfection in rates or in cross-subsidization, meaning there's always some element of cross-subsidization that's going on. But I think that by doing across the board and one rate for years, it's gotten out of whack. And so I don't know that it's a matter of not understanding. I do think it's a matter of not liking the change, and I certainly do understand that. But I think there's another perspective here, and as I said, I'm disappointed that we have not heard from those who have been doing the subsidization, because I haven't heard a lot of disagreement other than the disagreement that we can't do that under the master agreement. And I think that's certainly is a legal question, and we can differ on that. But if it is allowed and you look at it, I think that the way that Raftellis did the cost of service study and those things, I think they understand it.
Well, and I had said to Graham, to your point, I had said to Diane and Ted at one point that, you know, I would think we need to seek a third party opinion on the legal review of it. I mean, we're spending an awful lot of time talking about doing this and understanding the reason why. Can we do it? I mean, what's the legal take on it?
I think the legal question is one we'll certainly investigate. Our current perspective is that we can, but we want to be sure. But what we would like to do at this point is get a sense from the board of, I think that we are all of the opinion that revenue should mirror cost of service for the customer classes. I think we all pretty well agree with that. I think that's hard to argue. I think we can move in that direction over time. The inter-class equity piece is a question. You know, there's more than one question there. Is it legally allowed? Does the agreement allow it? We'll investigate that. But if we assume that the agreement does allow it, is that what we want to do? It's interesting to me that we haven't heard much of anything from the other members of the class who presumably are overpaying. But I think that we as staff believe we have some responsibility to ensure there isn't cross-subsidization based on the agreement, and interested in perspectives from the board on that specifically.
Well, I think that's the point, Ted. I think, you know, Peggy made a good point on that, and Diane raised it too. I mean, I think we're actually legally bound to make sure that one customer or set of customers is not subsidizing another. I mean, I almost make the counter legal argument that we would be in violation of the agreement if we didn't do something to stop cross subsidization. And so, I mean, I think that's, to me, is why I support going forward with this, is because I think we're legally bound to do so. I think it's unfair that what we're doing to some of our current customers, and we should do our level best to balance that that payment schedule.
On the legal question, Ted, if we had Rick or legal produce some kind of document that just outlines what we think our authority is here, something that we can use internally, but also, you know, uses when our customers are pushing back against this. And second, have we given much thought to the risk of litigation if we move forward with this? I mean, some of these two letters seem to raise that question.
I'm going to ask Rick to follow up. I'm going to give you the quick answer, Joel. And my initial reaction is, you know, I haven't seen any, or I don't recall any written legal opinion on what our ability is to change the rate structure in this way. We've certainly discussed it and believe that we have the flexibility there and even the responsibility there to ensure there isn't cross-subsidization. We have not had a lot of talk about the risk of litigation or what that means to the process, but we could certainly have that discussion today. Rick, do you have a perspective? Can you tell us if you have or someone there has produced an opinion on our ability to do a rate change or structure change?
Yeah, we have not been asked to give, nor have we given a formal opinion with respect to that general question or the specific question of the rates under consideration. We have, however, been continuously concerned about the issue and believe that under the agreement, the board certainly has authority to establish an equitable rate system and is to an extent required to not have a system of cross subsidies within our customer classes and within each class.
I don't understand the first part about what you said, Rick. You haven't been asked for a legal opinion.
What I meant to say, Sue, is that we haven't given a formal written opinion. I thought that was the question being asked in part. In other words, there has not been a formal opinion given.
Do we have to ask for that? I mean, if you serve at you serve this board, and if we're talking about doing something that you think needs to have a formal legal opinion, shouldn't that be something that you'd be advising us to do?
I certainly would have advised if I thought a formal opinion was necessary, but I hadn't heretofore thought that that was something that needed to be done. I've certainly given the informal opinion that this is permissible legally.
We've discussed it a number of times, but I guess I think that's different than a formal legal opinion, which we could ask for. And to your point earlier, Sue, we may want to have someone else take a look at it, given that Rick's firm was so intimately involved with creating the agreement. That might be an option as well.
And I asked, I'll add, not because I'm worried that we're wrong or that, you know, that the validity of it needs checked, but just I think it would be a useful tool as we're having these discussions with our customers, just something to hold up and say, here's, you know, what our official opinion is and what it's based on. So.
Sue, I don't want to imply that we're unwilling or unable to give a formal written opinion. I'm just saying that it hasn't come up heretofore.
Well, I've been hearing this question for 2 years from our suburban customers saying, we don't think you can legally do this. We don't think you can legally do this. So, I mean, in all the meetings that I've been in, that's one of the things. This isn't the first time they're saying it. So
I agree.
And I really think we need another opinion. We need someone not as close to it.
I don't want to be misunderstood, Sue. I have given the opinion many times orally and informally that this is permissible. It's just, I didn't want to mislead the board into believing that there's a document somewhere that sets forth this opinion in writing, because I don't believe there is.
We can certainly move in that direction, though.
I'm telling you, this board needs some cover, because we're throwing a lot of litigation out that we're going to, you know, that we're going to sue if they go for the rights of the water that we have. And, you know, right now, that's kind of the reputation that we have among the suburban customers. All Moyne Water Works will just sue. And if we don't have legs to stand on this, I'm going to know it now.
Sue, it's my view that we have ample authority to do this. But that's my opinion.
I want more than just those words personally as a board member.
And I'd be happy to do a written opinion, or we could have a third party opinion if that was the board's desire.
And I would just want to tack on to that, not only that we have the ability to do this, but that it's almost our legal obligation to do this. As Graham was pointing out, I was surprised to see in that slide that Peggy provided that it's explicitly stated that we should not be doing the cross subsidization. So to me, it makes me almost fearful that there could be a lawsuit waiting from our other customers in the wings for not acting on this sooner.
If I could address the timeliness of it, I think the occasion for looking at this specific method of adjusting rates came about when the Raftellus study revealed the nature and extent of the problem inherent in the existing rate. In other words, I don't think this was revealed in prior cost studies.
Ted, let me ask kind of from a strategy perspective. I mean, I share Sue's frustration about kind of where we are. I am fully in support of this because the logic, it's logical to me. I think this is what's being laid out here makes sense to me. But we have a strategy issue, right? I mean, we have to do, you know, we don't want to just go forward, you know, customers be damned. You know, we're right and you're wrong. And so I'm kind of curious to know what your thinking is about how to move this forward strategically.
Well, a couple different strategies. I think that The timing issue has come up as it relates to our regionalization discussions, but also as it relates to our budget cycle and our timeline for our annual rate adjustments. And I think that it's critically important for us to foreshadow to the wholesale customers what we think would be appropriate going forward long term. If there is no regionalization, if there is, but I think that it's important for us strategically in the regional discussions to decide how we intend to move forward as a utility, because the last thing we want to do is wait until customers make their decisions and then tell them we're going to change the rate structure. You know, I think they need to know that now. They need to know that before they make their decisions. I also think that the discussion that we're having informs the regional discussions, because it helps everyone understand where the costs are and how they need to be recovered. And if we go to a regional model, that there are going to be costs there that need to be recovered and options of how they can be recovered. So from a strategic perspective, I think it's important that we move this discussion forward. I certainly would not advocate moving forward without any consideration of their concerns or the perspective of whether it's legally allowed or not. But I think we've got a couple of pretty clear decision points here. One, we believe as staff that the wholesale rate has become somewhat misaligned with the cost of serving the wholesale customers. I think strategically we need to move in the direction of realigning that, and we need to let everybody know that. The other piece is purely an inter-class equity piece within the wholesale customer group. And that's more of a strategic question of how we handle that. I mean, Andrea just made the point that there's a non-cross subsidization requirement in the agreement. Does that include inter-class equity? I think that's a question we need to ask. Do we want to press that and address that? I think there's room for interpretation on both sides of that. But our interpretation is that we have some responsibility to develop a rate that's fair and equitable. So I think strategically it's important for us to come to some conclusion on what direction we think we will go as a board on rates, so that all these other decisions can be made here this year.
I'll say too that if we go to a regional entity and the regional entity is determining rates, all these issues are still going to be there. That this is not just a Des Moines Water Works because we're doing it kinds of questions. How you allocate these costs and making sure that you're not picking up somebody else's costs are things that that regional board would have to decide. The other thing I want to say in the master agreement, I can't believe anybody signed agreements and agreed that they would pick up somebody else's costs. You know, that doesn't make any sense to me. I've heard different entities say, well, nobody thought that when here's our understanding of what happened. But, you know, you wouldn't go into an agreement thinking, well, it's okay with me, especially understanding that there is some competition among the different customers for economic development or whatever, thinking that it would be okay with you to pick up somebody else's costs. So, you know, that being said, I do want to say that I am opposed to rate shock. I want to move into this in a deliberate manner. And as Ted said, I think it makes sense to let people know what our thinking is, that we get costs aligned and that costs are being covered, where they're being by those entities that are incurring those costs, and that we move in that direction. You know, you can move in a direction and move in it so slowly that you end up exacerbating what you've got. So we have to know where those tipping points are so that we can make some progress and not get deeper in a hole of cross-subsidization than before. But I mean, I think we have an obligation, at least on the inter-class. The intra-class gets trickier to do. But I think on the inter-class, we absolutely have to start on that. And then how we do the intra-class is something that we're going to have to determine whether or not we want to do that and how we go about doing that.
You know,
Peggy, I'm sorry, Ted, but Peggy, could you go back to the screen that shows us exactly what we're being asked today? And then go ahead, Ted, I'm sorry.
This is exactly where I was going to go, Graham. I don't remember how long ago it was. It seems like it's been years now that there was a suggestion from the board that we have, outside consultant look at our cost of service. And, you know, there was some concern over how it was being calculated both from the board and from wholesale customers. And we hired Raftellis, and they've been through it more than once now. And they've come to us with what they believe to be the, you know, an industry standard perspective on cost of service for retail customers and our wholesale customers. And there's some misalignment there. So, you know, where I was going to go is, you know, first of all, I think we need to ensure we have the right perspective from the board on whether we want to move towards realigning that in accordance with what Raftellis has suggested. And I'm talking retail versus wholesale. We feel pretty confident that that's what the board wants us to do. But if we can confirm that, we can make progress. The next question is, do we want to look at this other question about, bottom line, paying the maintenance costs on the infrastructure that each of the individual customers uses. That's what the fixed fee does. I think it's important to note that we're not asking people to pay maintenance costs based on how much purchase capacity they purchased. We're asking, or we're suggesting, that they pay that maintenance cost, the capital cost, I guess is the technical term that Raftellis uses, but the cost of maintaining that infrastructure that they use on their max day, unless they don't use any water, and then we're saying half of their purchase capacity. So we're not trying to penalize anyone for over purchasing, but do we want to move in that direction? Because that's a question. That's a policy question that the board can help us answer. And then if so, do we want to consider this inclining block, which is even a bigger step in that direction, and it looks at, you know, peak versus average more so than just how much water you use on your maximum day. That's kind of what we're looking for from the board today is, do we want to align wholesale revenue with wholesale cost? I think so. Do we want to consider implementing a capital cost or a fixed fee that covers the cost of facilities used on a maximum day? I think so, but that's a question for the board. It's a policy question. And some of our customers, to your point, Graham, feel that's a departure from the agreement. So I think those are the two critical questions for us today. Given those two answers, what we want to do is go back. We're just, you know, we're starting budget meetings on Monday. We'll be formalizing our budget in September, you know, kind of finalizing it, and then we'll be able to start showing you what that could look like if we knew what the board's pleasure was on those two questions.
You know, so, I want to make sure that the newer members on the board know that this not being able to have any kind of cross-subsidization is not a new bit of information for this board. We have known that. And in fact, when we have asked questions before, like, could we do this or could we do that? We were told, oh no, you can't do that because we cannot cross-subsidize into various groups. So this recent news through the RAFTELUS that we are in fact doing that is what's new news to me. And as one person, I am not comfortable deciding this today until we know legally what this contract says we can and can't do. Because if we make one decision today that how we want to do it, but then we find out, well, you do have these restrictions as part of the contract, I think that's going to change our approach to it. But I just want to make sure that, you know, primarily for our newer folks, that, you know, this is not new news. We thought we were clean on this.
So you answered the question I was going to ask you, and that was, do you feel comfortable making a decision without that legal question being answered? And your answer is no, right? I mean, do other people agree with Sue on that? That you're just, you don't feel like you have enough information until the legal question is answered?
But I'm one of the few non-attorneys. I mean, I'm so uncomfortable in this space. So one of the few non-attorneys.
That's a fair point, Sue.
And I'm not an attorney yet, so.
But you play one on TV.
I try not to. I would agree with Sue. I think it's easy enough to get a legal opinion. It seems like the prudent thing to do. Barring some information I don't know, I don't see why we wouldn't.
Well, I'll say I feel comfortable going forward, but I certainly, if people would like to see it spelled out more completely in a legal opinion, I would not oppose that.
And I'm going to add to it, I'd like a outside opinion as well.
So, Sue, could I understand you to be saying you'd like my opinion, my firm's opinion, plus an additional opinion from an additional attorney, a second opinion, if you will?
So you're muted.
I thought the way this would happen is you would give us your opinion. We would hand that off to someone else and say, this is what our legal is saying.
Understood. Okay.
I mean, that's my understanding. It's a legal opinion of, are you getting good advice or not?
Andrea, where do you come down on this?
I was just going to say, I support Joel and Sue and kind of getting that additional information, especially since I'm not familiar really with the initial conversations and intentions that were set up with this contract. I have some other questions and just curiosities, but I think that they're not necessary to be answered at this point. We'll just start with the legal opinion.
And Ted, mine's kind of a hybrid. I'm with Diane on the fact that I support moving forward on this. And, you know, as you consider doing this, I know there's a lot of balls in the air, but I hear what the other members are saying about the legal opinion, and I respect that. I think it's a good idea. I don't want us to lose too much ground. So if there's any way for us to keep moving forward while we answer these legal questions, you know, I urge you to find that path.
Yeah, we can certainly move forward with our budgeting process. And I don't think it'll take an enormous amount of time to get legal opinions on this particular question. So we will move that forward quickly. And of course, we're continuing with our regional discussions as well, which may make some of this, you know, less of an issue if we have a regional board that's involved in helping to set some of these rates. But we will certainly move forward on all fronts, Graham, and share those opinions with you as soon as we get them.
Let me just ask this very quick. I just not looking for a long discussion, just a quick answer here. Am I right in assuming that folks West Des Moines and Urbandale are a hard stop no on this because we don't have the authority, and that there isn't any additional discussion on how we might do this in a way that they would be supportive of?
You know, I think, Andrea, to Sue's earlier point, we need to respond to their correspondence. And there are some things in there that I think maybe they don't understand our intent. There was a comment, I believe, in the West Des Moines letter, and I don't have it at my fingertips, but I believe there's a comment in there about charging a fixed fee based on purchase capacity, and that's not the intent even. You know, the proposal was a fixed fee based on actual usage, which is different than and typically lower than purchase capacity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we need to make sure that they understand. I don't think that understanding those details on the edges is going to make them comfortable with what we've proposed. You know, I don't think that there's enough difference there. You know, I think that they're still going to believe that the agreement doesn't allow that. But, you know, you looked at it today pretty quickly, Andrea, and said, well, if we can't cross-subsidize, what we're going to get in trouble for what's happening already. And there's certainly room for interpretation there. And we'll get that interpretation.
And I mean, nobody, it's not intended to be punitive. I think when we got the Raftellis report and saw the extent to which, and there were some other things in there that we needed to realign. I think that's what prompted this. I will say when we get a second opinion, I would like us to get it from someone who is a rate attorney. So I can work with that, with you on that.
Okay. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
I just, you know, I want to say from my standpoint that I'm comfortable with the work that Raftellis has done. I don't question their work. I understand it. That's why I support moving forward. If others are uncomfortable, and I don't know if you are or not, but if you are uncomfortable, it's not a bad time to raise that too. But I just want to say for the record that I'm comfortable with the work that, and I'm pleased with the work that's been done to get us to this point.
No issues with their work. I'm comfortable as well. I will say that some of the finer points of this, or the, you know, kind of weighing the different options we have, are still, you know, they're still challenging issues for me to wrap my head around. And I think that maybe that speaks to my mental capacity, but I think it, moreover, I think it speaks to how challenging this is going to be, as Sue talked about earlier, to communicate this to the customers and those we're dealing with. And so I think we've got to put a lot of mental effort into thinking about how we're going to communicate this, and the legal opinion goes to that. I mean, I think that, as I said earlier, I'm less worried about our legal authority to do this, and more thinking that having a legal opinion would help, be helpful in communicating this to the public, to the media, to our customers, that not only is this something we can do, but this is something we have to do because we can't cross subsidize. So.
And I don't think there would be anything wrong with sitting down with them, not threatening them, we can do this, you know, sitting down with them and saying, you know, we heard you loud and clear, so we did seek our legal opinion. And then we wanted a second opinion too, and we would encourage you, take this to your legal. And if you are hearing something other than that, let's talk about it. I mean, I've said enough.
No, your point is well taken, Sue, in the fact that, I mean, that our discussions about regionalization and this discussion are one and the same, right? I mean, we have to, mm-hmm. we have to have an ongoing discussion with the people we serve and we sell water to make sure that they understand. And so this, as Diane, I think, pointed out earlier, this decision, whether it's made by us or made by a future regional board, has to be made. And it's going to have to be made in the same way, and that's by communicating. So your point's well taken. Any other questions or comments on this topic?
Ted, could you I think you've mentioned this earlier, but just talk briefly about timing. You know, we're looking here at this slide that lays out a few questions. When would you like to have answers on these questions from the board?
Well, good question. Let me start by saying that, you know, we're going to move our budget process forward at the normal pace. We really have to. We have to, for all practical purposes, have to approve the budget in November. And what we're going to do with rates informs where the budget is going to land in terms of how much revenue we're going to have. So, Peggy, do you want to comment on when we historically would need to make the rate decision in order to move the budget process forward on its appropriate timeline?
Yes. So actually, you know, the budget we bring to the board, well, finance and audit, and then the board in October, not for approval, but for the detailed review with the intent, or then for all practical purposes, the action is that the board sets a public hearing for approval in November. So, you know, what that really says is that the budget that you see in October, for all practical purposes, other than maybe a few small changes, needs to be pretty final in October, so that you can approve it in November, because otherwise in November you would be relooking at it. And I don't think that that's what you want to do. You want to be comfortable with what you saw when you actually go to approve it. So that being said, the rates are, you know, a pretty integral part. And what we actually typically do is have the board approve rates in October, at the October.
Let me ask you this. The budget is what the budget is. And once you get that amount of how much revenue do we need to essentially, you know, run the...
Diane, we've lost you.
Disappeared.
Yeah.
While she's dialing back in, just one other point I want to make to the board is that we don't have to decide on this in November. What we have to do is give our customers 6 months' notice of any rate change. And there, I know on at least one occasion the board was not comfortable before and we had to delay it until December. So the reason for that is simply to notify our ratepayers of the change. And I just want to make sure, again, our newer board members know that's the reason for the timeline. But if we are not comfortable with it, it's been done before and we can do it again to not move.
Correct, other than that does mean that we would either need to come in with a budget that doesn't have rate increases in it and therefore is a smaller budget, or has a, and we've never done this, it would be an unbalanced budget, i.e., you know, we don't know where this revenue is coming from. So you're correct, Sue, but I just want to point out that, you know, the budget needs to be balanced. So it would either need to be approved based off of no rate increases and come back later with those or something.
Well, wait, I'm sorry. And I think maybe you lost me when I was saying we need to figure out how much money we need in the budget and then we do the allocation. And aren't we talking about moving rate increases to July, realigning from making rate changes in July rather than April?
That's a proposal.
Well, does that change our timeline somewhat?
You know, it doesn't really change the timeline on the budget. You know, to Sue's point, we we usually try to approve the budget in November so that we have time to, you know, publish it and do the things we need to do. But we have at least one time delayed that approval. I think that the question here, though, the real question before us, are we going to change the rate structure? Because that's going to take some time to determine how that's all going to work and get it implemented and set up. Or are we not going to change the rate structure and we're going to adjust rates based on increases in cost and move forward, you know, much in the same way that we've done before. So mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit more of a question than we have had. We typically have when we're moving forward with the same rate structure, we're not making any changes there. It's just a question of, you know, how much the costs increase and how much do we need to adjust rates? And that's the question that I had for Peggy, is if we are going to make a rate structure change, you know, based on the slide that Peggy has up there, if we're going to implement a fixed fee, do we need to know that any earlier than just the normal rate approval process, or can we implement that if we know in October that if we make a decision in October?
So again, obviously we need to make sure that the budget is funded. You know, going back to where we kind of started, just, you know, at a minimum, you don't change the rate structure and you just raise the rates to, you know, the slide shows 287, but so let's say we weren't going to change the rate structure at all. I think we might still be looking at some sort of an implementation period, i.e. not going from necessarily what rates are today all the way to 287 in 1 year. We could, but it's as Diane says, rate shock. You know, rate shock isn't just about changing the rate structure, but do you want to go from not enough cost recovery to all 100% cost recovery in 1 year? I'm thinking probably not, although that is a board decision. So what I would say, you know, Ted, an option there is we plan the budget around that. If, you know, if we then decide to go forward with a rate redesign, you know, as long as the board approves it in time to give proper notice to our customers, and that the first implementation of it would in essence be the same amount of revenue as whatever we had included in the budget of just a straight rate increase, it could work. Or if it's more revenue, you know, you just figure out what to do with it. What you don't want is to decide after the budget is already in place that now we're going to give notice and implement this revised rate structure 6 months out, and it results in a reduction of revenue for us.
But I didn't get a real clear answer there. I had heard too that our rates were going to become effective as of July 1, and we heard all the reasons why. Is that July 1, 2021, or is that yet to be determined?
Sue, I would say that's the proposal, and it's yet to be determined. But that's what we're suggesting going forward, is that we change our rate implementation date to July 1. The board would have to approve that.
Well, and the reason I'm asking that is, again, the 6 months notice that we must give, maybe we're not up against a November deadline to determine the rates.
Yeah, and Peggy, is the November deadline also a function of budget and having our calendar year budget done and ready and in place by the first of the year?
Yes.
So the rates and the budget are very interrelated. And so if we don't know what we're going to do with rates, it's makes the budget, you know, finalizing the budget more challenging. But what I would say is that I believe we are going to determine the amount of revenue that we need to collect, and we will determine what influence that has on rates, and then we can begin implementation of whatever rate structure we settle upon to collect that amount of revenue. I suspect that the board will not support one big jump in revenue all the way to 100% cost recovery, but as Peggy said, that's something the board will have to decide. But what I think we need to do is identify our revenue need, and we can move forward with that. To Graham's point, we can keep moving forward on that front. We can review the legality of our authority to change rate structure, and then we can align those two things. And I think we have some time to do that late in the year, and then still have our budget done and in time, identify the revenue need, complete the budget, have it in place by the end of the year, determine what the rate structure is going to look like, and notify our customers 6 months in advance and implement the new rates on July 1. I think it can all be done. The thing I still don't know for sure is, when do we have to make that decision about rate structure to make this all work? And Peggy, is that a year-end decision-making point that we have to meet, or is it earlier than that?
Well, I think it goes back to what I said, as long as if we decide on a revised rate structure, as long as that revenue matches what's already in the budget, it absolutely could go to whatever is the last date that we need to be able to give 6 months notice. If it results in a different revenue number, then we would have to rework the budget and have it reapproved or something. So that's kind of the key there. I'm oversimplifying and thinking that, well, you base the budget off of simply raising the volume rate, and then later you decide, if we decide we want to go forward with a revised rate, you do it, but the revenue number needs to be equivalent. And it probably doesn't work out that perfect, but I think you could probably get it close. And then I think the real question is more, well, not I think, the question then is the notice to give time notice required given to customers. Let me put it this way. We could turn the rate structure on its head, and if it provided the same amount of revenue, then it has no budget impact. We wouldn't have to do anything to the budget. You know, that's where they're separate issues. You don't have to, you would not have to redo anything in the budget. The problem, that, as you pointed out, is, normally they correlate pretty closely. But if you want to totally, I don't know, pick some option, and I'm being on purpose here, pick some option that we don't even have on the table, as long as it ends up to be the same amount of revenue that we calculated the budget based off of, you're really only looking at the notification to customers.
Right.
And that's February 1st, right? If we go to a July 1 date.
It's 6 months, I believe. So January
1? Yeah.
Or is it January 1?
Yeah. It would be January 1, I believe.
January 1.
And I'm going to assume that we can make the rate structure change revenue neutral or close enough that we don't have to rework the budget. So we've got some time to make that decision. What I would like to propose is that we will move ahead with the budget process and our revenue determination, and we'll get the legal opinions, and we will bring those back to the board for consideration as soon as we have them.
Anything else on this topic? Don't want to rush it. Use the Zoom, pregnant, pause, wait for answers. Seeing none. We're all getting used to how we do this. All right. So moving on, I believe the next topic, we were going to talk a little bit about the botanical garden. Ted, you shared some information based on questions that came up at the board meeting.
Yes.
You can just go over those to make sure everybody's got them.
Yeah. Let me just take 2 minutes to give us a little background on the whole botanical garden relationship. It was 2004 that Des Moines Waterworks began to operate the botanical garden through an agreement with the city. And we won't get into that. I don't think that's particularly germane to the discussion, but we agreed that we would take over operation of the garden, the botanical center. We agreed to do that for 6 years from 2004 through 2009. But we ultimately ended up continuing to operate the garden through 2012. There was provision in there for extension. Throughout that entire time, the BC operated at a deficit, an annual deficit that started at more than $400,000 a year and averaged about $270,000 a year for the 9 years that we operated the BC, or about $2.4 million deficit. And that, to the best of my determination, includes any capital or operating expense that was not covered by revenue that was generated from the botanical garden. So about $2.4 million through that original period of time from 2004 through 2012. Now, in 2010, while we were still operating the center, a group of local business leaders came forward and offered a plan where a public-private partnership would take over operation of the botanical center. One caveat, though, was that they would need public support to continue for a period of time, and they asked Des Moines Waterworks to commit $200,000 of in-kind services and free water for 10 years. That proposal was reviewed with finance and audit in August of 2010, and the board approved that plan in August of 2010. But then it took that public-private partnership a couple of years to generate the capital they needed and kind of get their organization on its feet. So Des Moines Waterworks continued to operate the Botanical Center through 2012. And then on January 1 of 2013, operation was turned over and our 10-year clock started, if you will. So over the last 8 years, we have been providing that in-kind contribution, but in-kind has really transitioned more to cash contribution, paying of bills, and free water, and it's pretty much hit right on that $200,000 a year. They have used about 32 million gallons of water in that time, which is about $95,000 worth of water. And then some specific questions that came up at the last meeting. The cost to operate the botanical garden, both when we were operating it and having a deficit, and most of this time that we've been providing in-kind contribution, those costs have been assigned to the inside city cost of service, so just Des Moines customers. In the Raftellis cost of service analysis, they didn't pull that out, so it's more broadly distributed across the region. But as we all know from our recent discussion today, that cost of service hasn't been implemented yet. So for all practical purposes, the inside city customers have been paying those costs. There is only one water meter at the Botanical Garden. There's no separate meter for the restaurant or for the outdoor water use. It's all just one account, one meter. Peggy was able to find a 2019 income statement for the Botanical Garden And our in-kind contribution represents about 6% of the revenue that was shown on that income statement. And it appears that the Botanical Center is billed for sanitary and storm, but not for water. So I think that was answers to all the questions that came up. The information that we were able to find about the agreement. Any other specific questions?
It just it brings up the question to me, and Graham, maybe it's something that you could talk to them about, you know, going forward. Is that part of their contract that they have with Trellis, that they will provide free water, or is this going to come as a surprise if we put a meter, you know, on their restaurant?
I don't, that's a good question. My guess is it's never been discussed, that it's just they assume that they've got that water there and it's available to them. So yeah, that would be something that we would have to discuss with them. Again, I mean, here's just a recap, and you guys let me know what you want. I mean, there's a couple of options that we can move forward with here. One is, the contract is over on December 31st of 2022. And for, you know, a business standpoint, we could walk away from that contract at that point. If we were, if this were a business that I owned, I would argue that that's probably what we should do. Now, the fact of the matter is that, the Botanical Garden, while it is doing well and is an asset, and there's a new Rouen garden that will be opening up in the second phase in September, they still, and for their forever future, will rely on donor dollars to make things work. They are going to continue to have relationship with the city, and probably rightfully so, like the zoo and other entities do. The question for us is, what is the easiest way, and when I say easiest, from a political standpoint, for us to ease out of this contract? And so what I'm simply asking for is the ability to have a conversation with the garden about what a short extension might that could allow us to end this relationship forever, so that it's a little bit easier than ending it cold turkey on December 31st, 2022. Ted and I have talked amongst the two of us in broad terms about thinking of this as a five-year scenario, meaning starting now. So the remaining 2 years of the contract as written, with the 3 years that would quickly spin out of that financial component, which I think is the most important. And then also get us out of the water portion, so that at the end of 5 years, meaning 2025, we would not be subsidizing them in any way. But and if the board was interested in pursuing a scenario like that, Ted and I would have quiet conversations with the executive committee and others, just to see what was possible. We wouldn't commit to anything. But if the message from the board today is we should be done on 2022 and not have any, you know, and not look for a softer landing, message heard, and we can move that way.
Thanks, Graham, and I'm glad we're having this discussion, and I think, you know, putting together the history of this and where we are is helpful to everybody. I'm going to talk about my perspective, but you know, again, this is only my perspective. I look at this and with water and contribution and what was supposed to be in-kind contribution and is now turned to cash. I think it's about, if I look at it and add it right, and it's about $4.5 million over that period of time. That's wrong. As we all know, math is not my strong suit. So,
pretty close, Diane.
Am I close?
Very close. Very
close. When I read all the minutes from the time, I thought that this was the exit plan. And, you know, I guess if we were doing it over, it's always the hindsight is 20/20. We would have had declining amounts as opposed to an abrupt exit. But I know, and I said this before, you know, we've had to put an additional charge on our customers because of the state of our distribution lines. That's a lot of money. I would rather it were going into distribution. I read one of the statements made in one of those committees that they understood that we don't make charitable contributions. And if we did, there are all kinds of entities that could use that money. So I think that the 10-year plan that was negotiated and that everybody understood at the time has been more than fair. I really like the Botanical Center. I want to get that on record. I've been a member there. I think that was the exit plan, and I would stay with the exit plan.
I regret not being able to be part of the conversation at the last meeting this was discussed, but luckily I had the conversation with Ted, who kind of filled me in on this. And tricky issue, and I hear Peggy's comments. I think a kind of glide path or a stair-stepped approach seems like maybe the most practical way to get Waterworks out of the botanical garden business. I worry that if we cut it off cold, that in 2021 and 2022, we'll be facing a lot of political pressure and renewed requests to, you know, renew the contributions and to you know, maybe even increase them. I think creating some kind of stair-stepped exit from the agreement is the best, you know, a very clear signal that, you know, this is how we're ending it, this is when we're ending it, and it's got to come to an end. So I think there's some good logic behind a kind of stair-stepped approach, and I'm pretty supportive of that. So that's where I stand.
I'll just add that I can appreciate that we're talking about this now, right? So 2 years out, giving the conversation a thought and bringing it to the attention of the Botanical Center, and so it's not as cold turkey as what it could be. I think similar to what Joel said, similar to what Graham laid out, there's an opportunity to kind of do some type of phasing. What that is, I'll leave to others to propose and bring back. But even if it includes something where a portion, whether it's the free water or the in-kind contribution cash, does stop cold turkey in 2022, and then we work on slowly phasing the second component out over the next 3 years, could be an option. But
I'm sorry, Andrea, what was the second component? I didn't understand that.
So from
the water?
Yes, we have the water and the in-kind, which is just cash, right? So is there an opportunity to stop one of those in 2022? and then phase the next one out or the second part out. I think that there's a variety of options that can be discussed, and I'm open to thinking about those and having a conversation with them. But I also want to keep in mind that it is 2 years out, and it won't be cold turkey. So I'm not afraid to turn at least a portion of it off or start scaling things back in 2022. If that makes sense. Knowing that this isn't a devastating amount of their budget. It is significant, but not devastating.
Thanks for that, Andrea. I think that Ted and Peggy would agree that stopping the financial portion of it would be beneficial. Sue, what are you thinking?
Well, I think we need to give you some boundaries. I think that's what I hear you asking for, Graham. And what I hear Diane saying and Andrea is that, you know, maybe the cash has to stop. I mean, that is a non-negotiable possibly with this board. Maybe continuing to give a portion of the water free over 3 years, but with the understanding that they would have to ensure that Trellis knows that going forward, they're going to have to pay for their water. I think I hear you, Graham, saying, give me some boundaries here. What's the intent of the board before there's any kind of a conversation? So maybe that's the real question. What are we thinking? What is the glide plan out? Is it 30%, 30%, 30%, or is it all cash off the table? I mean, I don't know.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think the first question is one, are we interested in doing anything beyond 2022? And it sounds like there's a majority of the board that says possibly. I mean, they're not saying that they want to, but it's worth having that discussion. The second piece of it, you know, I agree, and I think all of us agree, that the most important thing is to stop the cash payments as soon as possible. What that means, I don't know. I mean, I guess what I'm proposing is that Ted and I have the ability to have those quiet discussions with the Botanical Garden leadership to figure out the temperature level over there without giving them an ultimatum that we're going to stop all payments. We're not going to give them a dollar after 2022. And then when we have those quiet conversations, be able to come back to the board and say, no agreement, but this is the temperature that we took over there and what our sense is. At that point, then I think the board could give very clear direction about that phase out plan. Does that make sense, Ted? I mean, that's kind of what you and I talked about.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a difficult conversation, whatever conversation we have. But with that direction, I think we can certainly go have the conversation and bring back a proposal.
And kind of fill us in, how are you two thinking this conversation happens? Is it an agenda item that you put on their finance committee? Is it a sit down with Stephanie? What does the conversation look like?
Yeah, I think the conversation would be with the CEO, with the possibly the board chair, maybe it's not different than ours. They have a board chair, and then they have an incoming board chair. The current chair is Stacy Johnson from John Deere. The incoming board chair is Ed Kinney. Maybe they'll have the finance chairperson there, but no bigger group than that. Just as an idea, as I say, it's more of a temperature taking. And I say that because it's important. I mean, I think that as much as I don't want to have our board negotiating in public, I don't want the Botanical Garden board necessarily negotiating in public. None of us in that small group conversation is going to have the authority to sign a deal or to commit either entity. It's more of a temperature taking type of conversation with some leaders over there. And then from there, Ted would probably put together some sort of a document for us to discuss, then that we would then actually do that next phase, Sue, that you're talking about, and actually talk about what the dollar amounts are, how that works, and at that point we would approve it and send it over to the Botanical Garden. Because remember, in a way, we're not negotiating, really. I mean, it's not like there's a real give and take here between the two entities. What we're doing is finishing up a long-term agreement that I think doesn't matter, that we're in. And so figuring out that path that's smoothest for all of us.
I would, Graham, you mentioned something that struck me, or that I've been thinking about, and that I think one of the reasons I'm comfortable with you taking the temperature, you and Ted meeting with them, is because we're, well, I was going to say negotiating from a point of strength, but we're not even really negotiating. I mean, this is a gratuitous matter. And so if, you know, you discuss some options with them and bring them back to the board, and we may maybe think they're too gratuitous and don't want to move forward, we're in a position of strength where we don't, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, we're really not softly locking ourselves into anything, because this is a rather, you know, almost entirely gratuitous matter. Kind of talking myself in circles here, but I hope that made some sense.
Right. I mean, that's exactly right. Is that what I hope to be able to do is to have some conversations so that they're not stunned by what we're doing, that we actually explain to them why we have to get out. Remember, all of these people in some respects are ratepayers. And so I think they're going to understand the point that this isn't our mission and we have to make that clear to them. But then, you know, figure out that path forward. What I don't want to have happen, or what I'm trying to head off at from happening, is some sort of lobbying effort that happens from that board to our board to try to, you know, strong arm us into doing something. I'm trying to reach an agreement that is easy to understand, that this board can accept and that board can accept without any animosity.
You know, I think from my perspective, having been here the whole time that this has gone on, right or wrong, 16 years ago, we hitched their wagon to our horses and we've been helping them plow for all these years. And for better or for worse, that's created a perspective that we're part of the team and we're here to help. And I fear that if we just cut that off cold turkey, there's going to be shock and dismay. I desperately want to get out of this, but I want to do it in a way that's amicable and ends it without uprising. And so I think Graham's right. We go to them and we explain to them that, you know, our board's really kind of fidgety about this. Should we ever have even done it? And here we are after 16 years, it's going to be 18 by the time we get to the end of this. We want to have a good faith exit and we want it to happen pretty quickly. And I just feel like that's going to be easier if there's a little bit of a glide path. And that's,
oh, come on, Ted, don't you want to be sitting at the table like we were with the zoo and have him hand the keys over to you? Come on. That was so cool.
I got enough keys, Sue. I got all the keys I can.
Well, so. I think I hear pretty clearly that Ted and I need to go, and then there's a couple important things here. There's a couple of important guidelines. One, these are quiet conversations that we're going to have with a few people. We're not there to sign a deal or even have a handshake deal with them. It's just a matter of us, I keep reusing this phrase, but I think it's an appropriate one, taking the temperature over there to figure out kind of our parameters. And I say our parameters, the parameters that Ted and I have to come back and put together something that is a more formal document to bring to this board to consider. And I think that there seems to be strong agreement that financial portion is something that we need to be serious about and figure out the quickest exit ramp on that. And the water, I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, Sue brings up the zoo. I mean, we've we've paid a lot here, and we've drawn a line in the sand that we don't want to provide and will not provide free water. And so stopping that for this entity is as important as anything, although it's least costly to us. But so, I hear those messages, and if it's all right, I mean, that's how we'll proceed. And we'll do this from a timing standpoint. I don't think Ted and I would have any meetings over there until September. And we'll have those, and we'll report back as soon as we can. Anything else on this topic?
Good luck.
Thank you. Ted, what do you have for the good of the cause this afternoon?
You know, thank you for your time as always. And I will be out of the office on Thursday and Friday, but in town. Peggy, you're here, right? Thursday and Friday? I think we had this conversation already.
We didn't, but yes, I am.
Okay. Peggy will be wearing all the crowns on Thursday and Friday. So
she wears them.
She wears them very well, indeed. And that's all from me today, Graham.
Although your glass slippers don't fit her.
They do not.
Well, at least I have extra room as opposed to them being too small.
True. Yeah. Thanks for having my back on that one, Piggy.
All right. Well, everybody, thanks for your time. Stay healthy.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.